This is Lake Effect for Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Welcome to the show. Thanks so much for tuning in this morning. The Great Lakes hold 20% of the world's surface freshwater, and increasingly, they also hold a host of worrisome chemical compounds known as contaminants of emerging concern. According to the Alliance for the Great Lakes, those compounds can originate from everyday products, from shampoos to textiles to home furnishings. The Chicago-based organization released a report last week titled Keeping Great Lakes Water Safe: Priorities for Protecting Against Emerging Contaminants. WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bent sat down with a local scientist to learn more about the issue. Matt Dellinger recently completed his PhD dissertation on contaminants of emerging concern and human health risks associated with them. He describes himself as a human ecological health risk assessor.
The way my research took off was I started by conducting a review for the Health Professionals Task Force, which is now the Health Professionals Advisory Board. And their job is to advise the International Joint Commission on a variety of topics relative to health and the Great Lakes. And they approached me to conduct a review of these chemicals of emerging concern. And so given my history for the couple years before that with learning how the ecosystems are measured and how the health of ecosystems are measured in terms of the populations and their interactions, and keeping that in mind as I went forward, getting back into my health sciences and looking at basically doing a human health risk assessment in which you try to assess what are the potential risks to human beings based on a variety of factors, in this case chemicals, I realized that there was a very, very strong need for innovative, fresh techniques to apply to human health risk assessment to deal with the realities and the limitations of our ability to assess what the risks are from these chemicals that we don't fully understand, and we don't even sure how many there are. And so I then brought in robust quantitative methods to not only conduct field research to sample the environment, but also to take that information and blend it with the kind of information that someone who's an epidemiologist or a health science or a risk assessor would use to try to bridge these two worlds and overcome the obstacles that are presented and exemplified by the chemicals of mutual concern.
What is known about the chemicals, Matt?
One thing that we do know is that there's lots of them. Lots of them. Another thing that we know is that we're exposed to them, not just through drinking water, but through food. Infants are exposed through the womb and when they're born through breast milk. Sometimes we inhale these things, like when we're on our couch, we'll inhale flame retardants. That's one of the chemicals of mutual concern. We know that a lot of them are biologically active. You can take a lot of these chemicals and you can do what is called an in vitro or in vivo study, and you can expose, for example, human cells to these chemicals, and you can observe the reaction by the human cells and infer that if this was happening within the human body, that some sort of physiological response would occur. What we don't know is exactly what responses might occur in some cases, and we're not sure in many cases what the potential dose response might be. Oftentimes, studies are conducted from an epidemiological perspective where you take a cohort of human beings, you assess what their exposure has been, and then you pick health outcomes that you might hypothesize would be related to, for example, their serum levels of their blood levels of PBDEs, which are flame retardants, or perfluorinated surfactants, things like that. Those are a couple of chemicals of emerging concern. You assess those levels and you try to compare, based on people's differing levels of the contaminant, what the increased risks are of something like hypothyroidism, or some studies might look at like sperm counts. And there are a variety of studies that have found slightly increased risk associated with these types of chemicals. But as I said, it's all it's fairly nebulous in terms of what the actual health outcomes are.
My impression was that we're talking about chemicals that are making their way into, you know, river streams, into the Great Lakes. But you're talking about chemicals that are, you know, around us and are working in living habitats.
Yes, like the ether. Water and drinking water is an important exposure route, but it's not the only one. The strength of looking at drinking water is that it's already regulated, at least to an extent. And that's really where a lot of the impetus for these investigations comes from. Is another characteristic of this category of chemicals is that oftentimes there's not really a clear regulatory framework in which to monitor them. And so that's what some people have been proposing is prioritization schemes and regulatory frameworks and safe levels to assess in drinking water. But if you're finding these chemicals in water, you're going to find them in, for example, the fish that we eat. And it's fair to say that in many cases, if it's in the water, it came from somewhere. And that somewhere sometimes is like a farm, for example, where some of these chemicals, a lot of it ends up in meat and dairy. And pesticides also. You can find pesticides running off into water. Oftentimes that's because they ran off of an agricultural field where they were applied to crops, and they'll often get into, like, lettuce, for example. So, yes, it's everywhere.
You talked about the influence of having part of your research and working directly with, again, people in the community, interviewing, gathering data, looking at health, you know, what's going on in that public health arena in a very localized level. Has that really provided you with a grounding in your work?
A grounding? Well, I'll interpret grounding. I'll use my own interpretation of what I think grounding is. When I started, when I started undergraduate school, I came from the perspective of, I'll take a shortcut and say tree hugger. When I was very young, I loved animals. I cared about animals. And I was always fascinated and enthralled with the natural environment. And as I guess they call us millennials now, I'm at the very top end of millennials. I'm not as young as I look, but people in my generation have watched with great anxiety as the beautiful, beautiful natural world around us at least seems to decay. And so I started school with that perspective of what people from the other side of the spectrum might call alarmism. And so to the extent that I've been grounded, yes, when you delve into the philosophy behind how we study things, when you look at all the evidence, if you're a good scientist, in my opinion, you start to break down your biases as best as you can. And I do feel like one of the important steps in my development has been to somewhat ground myself. And that to me really means understanding other perspectives. For example, I understand the perspective of someone who might argue with me about, well, we conducted all these studies about flame retardants, and we've really not seen that at the levels they're occurring in the environment, we've not really seen any human health effects. So you are really drumming up fear over nothing. Whereas maybe when I started out as a younger man, I might have thought that they were corrupt. But I do understand that philosophy. I understand that's just a different risk perception, and it's fairly sensible. I also understand that the people who tend to make those arguments are the people who tend to work for the chemical companies. And I try not to be cynical about it, and I think it's extremely important that to bear in mind that, especially as a scientist, as someone who may be accused of being perhaps alarmist, it's important to keep a skeptical mind so that we don't invoke unintended consequences with the type of research and outreach that we attempt. And so community-based research and having a more systemic view of the type of research and indeed studying that aspect of the research should incorporate all perspectives. Bear in mind that, for example, I've brought up flame retardants a few times. A common example that people use when they talk about the cost-benefit of using a chemical is that we know that flame retardants in a stuffed teddy bear will prevent that teddy bear from bursting in the flames and, you know, cooking our children. The teddy bear in my son's crib has flame retardants in it, even though I know there are risks associated with those flame retardants. And we need to bear in mind that there's always going to be a cost-benefit analysis that we need to make when we make decisions.
The reason that I called you was because of a document that came out having to do with chemicals of emerging concern. When people listen to this and they maybe look at that document, which will be attached to our website, what do you think for somebody listening and hearing about these issues is most critical?
It's extremely important that people understand how much and how little we know. It's almost paradoxical. The more we know, the more we realize we don't know. And perhaps people older than me will say, of course, that's how life goes. The key takeaway points from that report are that there are many, many, many chemicals, and this was just focusing on surface water and drinking water. And the proposal within the report, their main point was that we need prioritization schemes and we need methodologies to direct our energy to try to manage this. And that's where innovation is going to come in. And what I would like people to understand is that we're not going to... The innovation is going to be... This is my opinion. It's theoretically possible to fully understand, of course. It's theoretically possible to research something almost to death and then, for example, recognize that smoking's bad for you and that it causes cancer. Actually, you can't really... Technically, I shouldn't say that as a risk assessor. It doesn't cause cancer. You can smoke all your life and not have cancer. It's a risk factor for cancer. And that's a really important thing for people to understand. We're talking about risk. Cause is implied in some sort of in this underlying phenomenon. And what people really need to understand is that, first of all, it's important that they think critically and assess what makes sense to them. It's also important that they criticize their own biases, and that if we're going to get a handle on any of these issues, we're going to have to make very sensible, educated decisions that are not going to... We ultimately cannot rely on a silver bullet, either in research or technology, to solve these problems for us. Of course, innovations will help, but sooner or later, everyone's got to make a judgment call, and that's going to be the key. No matter how advanced our techniques get, no matter how sophisticated our decision-making frameworks are, at the end of the day, it's a judgment call, and it's important that scientists, policymakers, and the community are engaged in that process.
Matt Dellinger is a postdoctoral researcher in the Department of Biological Sciences. He's working in the Aquatics Ecology Lab at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. He spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz about a new report from the Alliance for the Great Lakes on emerging contaminants. There is a link to that study from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Coming up next, there have been a lot of books about the history of the Green Bay Packers, but few have covered the remarkable financial history of the football team, as does Bill Povletic's new book. We'll chat with him just ahead on Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.